It is an absolute joy to be back home in Minnesota. My wife and I moved here back in 2011 to begin teaching at take a job at North Central University. We're able to enjoy our time there up until 2023. This is my, I think, fourth or fifth time being able to speak at the camp. And I'll tell you, the first time my wife and I were here, we were a childless couple. The second time we came with our firstborn, Steele, who will now you'll meet. He's 11 years old. The third time we came, we're also foster parents. We came with a new baby. This time, we now have a sibling set. And I'm worried about coming again. Because now we're up to three. And two babies and our son, and we did have the joy of driving this whole way up here. And if you've ever driven with babies, I told my wife, by the time we got here, I don't think anyone's going to be sanctified in this car. But we absolutely made it, and it's a joy to be here. This morning, I want to talk to you a little about the figure of Moses. Moses is someone who also has a very interesting backstory. When we come to Moses in the book of Exodus, Moses is a young man who is a child of privilege. He's a man who is raised as an Egyptian in the home of the Pharaoh, even though he's an Israelite. We see Israel in the story in great crisis in Exodus chapter 1. There is a Pharaoh who is worried about how fast Israel is growing, worried about their influence in the country. He begins to enslave them. That doesn't slow them down, so he begins to order that the newborn babies, the male babies, be killed. And it's in that story that Moses, his mom, hides him. She's worried about losing her child. The baby is found by the daughter of the Pharaoh, brought into the Pharaoh's home. And if all we had in Exodus was chapter 1, it would be like a great story of how God saved one child. But then we come to chapter 2, and we see a character, Moses, who's raised up as an Egyptian, but still feels the sorrow of his people. Moses in the story begins to fight against the Egyptians. He kills a man who was beating an Egyptian or an Israelite slave. When that's uncovered, he goes and he flees and he goes to Midian. And in one chapter, we see the character of Moses as someone who goes from the high life to a humble life. And here's how the story is described. And I'm going to read, this will be our text this morning. We're going to look at a longer text. I'm not going to read it. I'm going to read one text this morning, Hebrews chapter 11. And I'm going to begin reading here at verse number 24. Here's what the author of Hebrews says about Moses. By faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He chose to be mistreated along with the people of God rather than enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. He regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as of greater value than the treasures of Egypt, because he was looking ahead to his reward. By faith, he left Egypt, not fearing the king's anger. He persevered because he saw him who is invisible. Moses persevered because he saw him who is invisible. What I'm going to talk about this week, Monday through Thursday, is I'm going to talk about every time Moses has an experience of God on a mountain. In the Bible, mountains are places where you can meet with God. Why? Because mountains are as high up as you can go. Mountains are as close to the heavens as you can go. And most people, when they climb up on a mountain, they climb up alone. They go up there, they have an experience with God. In the ancient world, mountains were a place to meet with God. In fact, when we come to the story in Genesis of the Tower of Babel, what is that point of the story? That humanity was trying to create a man-made mountain so they could control their own access to God. Moses, throughout his ministry, throughout his life, has experiences with God on a mountain. And each experience can teach us something about our own relationship with God. So I'm going to begin looking this morning at his first experience on a mountain. And it begins in Exodus chapter 3. And here's where we find Moses. Moses is a man who fled from Egypt because he killed an Egyptian by siding with the Israelites. He flees Egypt. He knows they want to kill him. He goes to the land of Midian. Midian is all the way on the other side of the water. There he meets a family of girls who are being persecuted by shepherds. He comes to their defense. They bring him home to their dad, and eventually he marries one of them, which is a great story. You want to marry someone? Just come to their defense. What happens is he now enters this man's employ. His name is Jethro, and he becomes a shepherd. And here's the crazy thing about the story, if you're not aware of it. Egyptians hated shepherds. They absolutely hated shepherds. They wanted nothing to do with shepherds. When the people of Israel first moved to Egypt, Joseph, who works for Pharaoh, says to the Israelites, when they ask you what you do for a living, be sure to tell them you're shepherds. Because if you tell them that, they will give you your own land because no one wants to live next to you. You want to have your own neighborhood? Just tell them you're a shepherd. When Moses lives as a shepherd for the next 40 years of his life, he takes on a job that would make him obnoxious to all of Egypt. Moses is now fully not an Egyptian because he's taken on the lifestyle that no Egyptian would ever want to be around. And it's at that place that Moses comes to his first mountain, a mountain known as Mount Horeb. We think that Mount Horeb may actually be, and I think I have a map here. Here's the land of Midian. There's Egypt. Horeb's in the middle. Horeb is Moses walking away from the land of Midian and getting as close to Egypt as he possibly can. Now, why was he doing that? We don't know. Some people have argued maybe there was a drought and he was trying to find where he could feed the sheep. Some have said that we know by the end of this story, his brother Aaron, his older brother who still lives in Egypt, is going to meet him. So maybe they were choosing a neutral place in which to meet. But for whatever reason, Moses is alone. He takes his flock to Horeb. And at Horeb, he sees a sight that astounds him. He sees a bush that is burning, but it's not burning up. And in this land, in this arid land, and again, if you want to think of who Moses is at this point in his life, realize for 40 years he grew up in a palace, and for the next 40 years he grows up in the wilderness. At this point, Moses is pretty much a survivalist. He knows how to live in the wilderness. He knows how to make a fire. He knows how quickly a bush can burn. And when he sees the bush not burning up, he has to go over to investigate. And as soon as he goes over to investigate, and we can go to the passage here, as soon as he goes over to investigate, Moses finds the God of Israel. He hears a voice calling out of the bush, and what does the voice say? The voice says, "Moses, Moses." And right away, I want you to understand, in the ancient world, when you called someone's name twice, that was always interpreted as a term of affection. You know, just like today, how we call people tells you whether or not you're in trouble. How many of you remember growing up and your mom called you by your full name? And you knew when that happened, the first thing you were wondering was, what did I do, right? My mom says, "Don Allen Tennyson," I'm like, oh my goodness, I'm in trouble. In the ancient world, if your name is called twice, it's always a term of affection. Moses hears his name twice. And what does he say? He says, "Here I am." And right away, I want to teach you something about divine encounters in the Old Testament. And let's go here to this slide. In divine encounters in the Old Testament, they always happen in the same three steps. Number one, God calls someone by name and they respond. Number two, God reveals who he is, and they respond with fear. And then number three, God has a dialogue with them about their situation. We find this happen right in the story of Moses. God calls him by name. He calls with affection, "Moses, Moses." In fact, I want you to try this. How many right now are you sitting next to your spouse? I want you to turn to your spouse and I want you to say their name twice in as affectionate a way as you can. Now, if you're not sitting next to your spouse, don't be creepy. But if you are, you can say that. And right away, Moses responds, yes, because it's affectionate. He hears his name in a safe way. He says to God, here I am. And then God says, and this is step number two, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And right away, Moses is afraid, because here's what happens with divine encounters in the Old Testament. The first time you're called, you're not really sure what's going on. When you realize it's God who's calling you, suddenly everyone thinks they've been called to the principal's office and they're about to die. Right? Like, God, why are you coming to me right now? Oh my goodness, what have I done? Or God, you know what I've done. I'm in trouble. And every time God has to settle people, I didn't call you in order to kill you. Settle down. I want to talk to you about your circumstance. And that's what happens in this story. In fact, the one thing that's unique about this story, it follows all these other stories, but the one thing that's unique is this. He says to Moses, take off your shoes because you're on holy ground. And right away, we see something that's going to be a part of the life of Moses for the rest of the story. When we talk about holiness, holiness is the way of referring to God's otherness. Because here's one truth about God that is so distinct from everything else. Only God is uncreated. Only God is uncreated. Everything you experience is created. Everything you see in life once did not exist, now it does exist, and at some point in the future is not going to exist again. Everything is created. But when you come to the presence of God, you come to that which is uncreated. And in the presence of what is uncreated, the distinction is so real, it's so different, that in creation, the uncreated can become dangerous. And God tells Moses right away, you're in the presence of what is holy. You're in the presence of what is uncreated. You need to take off your sandals. Why? Because you're bringing the dirt to that. You need to take off your sandals because you're on holy ground. And here's the thing we're going to see throughout the entire life of Moses. We're going to hit this in a much bigger way tomorrow. But all of Moses and his leadership of Israel is about Moses trying to manage the holiness of God. Because when God is with Israel, the uncreated is in the midst of God's people. And if Israel's going to learn how to live with God's presence, they're going to have to learn how to manage that. One illustration I like to give for that is every time you raise a child in a home, and as I said before, my wife and I are foster parents. We sometimes have had kids who come to our home with a very different experience than what our home is like. I remember I had one child who came in, and you realized they didn't know how to live in a home where people weren't constantly screaming at each other. They didn't know how to live in a home where from time to time, men weren't trying to break down the door. And living in our home was such a unique experience, they had to learn how to live with that. All of us who are raised up in a household grow up learning how to live with the people who raise us. And then what happens is we get married and we have to relearn all over again how to live with someone. Because how many know whoever you marry is not the person that was from the home you were from? Right? Sometimes the biggest conflict in marriage is I'm marrying someone who learned a whole different set of lessons than what I learned and how to live with someone. And now I have to learn how to live with them. In fact, I love this quote from Martin Luther. Great Protestant reformer, Luther, for the first time, got married when he was 46 years old. He married a nun who had left the convent because she read Luther's writings. And now she's a single woman who left because of Luther, and Luther felt like, well, the least I could do is marry her. And they got married both late in life. And Luther would later write this about marriage. He said, I always thought I was a good person until I got married. And here's what he described marriage as. He said, marriage is this.
It's God's school for building character. Marriage is God's school for building character, because now what I have to do, I have to learn how to live with someone who's not like me. Here's the thing, marriage becomes the biggest analogy in the Old Testament for Israel's relationship with God. Because if they're going to have to learn to live with God, it's like they're entering into a new world, a new relationship, a new life with someone who is completely different from them. And all of the Pentateuch and the law is about learning what? Learning how to live with God. And what does it begin with? It begins with what God says to Moses, take off your shoes. You're standing on holy ground. And then God does number three. Number one, he calls Moses. Number two, he tells Moses who he is. And number three, he begins to dialogue with Moses about their circumstance. He begins to dialogue with him about their circumstance. Let's go to the next slide here. And Moses says to, God says to Moses, I've seen you. I've seen Israel. I've heard their misery. I love how he puts it. He says, I see their misery. I hear their cries. And I'm concerned about their situation. When he looks at Israel, God says, I see it, I hear it, and I feel it. How many want to know that that's true about God in your own life? I see it, I hear it, and I feel it. And he says to Moses, I'm talking to you because I'm going to make you the answer to the problem that Israel is facing. And Moses in this story raises the first of three major questions in this narrative. There's three questions that govern the narrative in Exodus 3 through 4. And the first question is this. Moses says to God, who am I? Who am I that you should send me back to Egypt? When Moses is saying this, understand, Moses was raised in the home of Pharaoh. Moses knows what it's like to talk to Pharaoh. But at the same time, when Moses had the opportunity to stand up to Pharaoh, what did Moses do? He fled Egypt altogether. Moses put his tail between his legs and he ran at the first sign of conflict. And now 40 years later, when he's given up that life entirely, when he's walked away with that dream, when Moses is now living a life that he's going to die in his mind doing, I'm going to take care of my father-in-law's sheep until the end. God says to Moses, I want you to go back to Egypt. I want you to tell Pharaoh to let my people go. And Moses' first question is this, who am I that you should ask me to do this? God, I already had an opportunity to do something 40 years ago, and I blew it. I had the opportunity to stand up, and I ran the other direction. Why are you calling me now? And in fact, Moses could say this, why are you calling me 40 years after the fact? And what is God's answer? He doesn't tell Moses, I'm calling you because I think you're awesome. Moses, I'm calling you because I really like what you do with shepherding. Moses, I'm calling you for this reason or that reason. God only gives one reason, and the reason is this. Moses, I'm calling you because I'm with you. Moses' question is, who am I? God's answer, it doesn't matter, I'm with you. Doesn't matter who you are to get in the room, I'm already with you. I'm already with you. I mean, you know, sometimes you can get into some spaces not because of who you are, but because of who you're with. There's some doors that open to you because you're walking in with the right person. God says to Moses, it doesn't matter who you are. All that matters is that I'm with you. And there's one lesson I want to give you about the call of God. I'm going to say three things about God's call today. It's not going to be on the slide. I'm just going to tell it to you. But the first lesson is this. The call of God doesn't require that we be the best because God is already the best. The call of God doesn't require that we be the best. God, I'm not the best person at this. I'm not the one you should call for this. I'm not the most articulate. I'm not the smartest. I'm not the fastest. I'm not the most athletic. Why are you calling me? God's not calling you because he thinks you're the best. He doesn't need the best. He's already the best. He's just calling you. He's just calling you. Years ago, when I was at Cedar Valley Church, this is the church I attended when I was living here, I remember one Sunday morning, I felt like I really had to go to the bathroom during service. And I'll tell you, as a preacher, one of your biggest fears is your body will not cooperate with you when you're getting ready to preach. But this time I was just in the audience, and I got to do something that I love getting to do. I got to walk out of church because I wasn't speaking that morning. And I remember, this is going to be too much information, but I'm going to tell you anyway. I really had to go, and I had to go so badly, I went to a bathroom on the far side of the building so no one would smell what was about to happen. Bathroom I'd never gone to before. I went to the restroom, I come out, and as I'm walking out, one of my students from North Central is walking towards the exit. And I stop her. And I'm like, hey, how are you doing? Service is still going on. She says, oh, I'm doing okay, Dr. Tennyson. She said, I said, well, I didn't know you come to church here. I've never seen you before. She goes, no, I was just visiting today. I said, oh, what for? She said, well, your youth pastor has said that he's looking for people to help him as youth sponsors. And so me and a bunch of other students from North Central drove to church this morning so that we could volunteer to help out with the youth group. And I said, well, church isn't over. Where are you going? And she said, well, she said, I went with a bunch of other girls. And every girl I went with looks like a youth pastor. They're athletic. They're tall. They're pretty. She wasn't athletic. She wasn't tall. She didn't have those classical looks. And she said, when we all went up to meet the youth pastor, he talked to every person in the group but me. And she said, I've decided I don't look the part. God's not calling me to youth ministry. And she said, in fact, I was walking out the building and I said to God, if you're still calling me to ministry, I want you to have someone stop me before I hit the doors. And she said, and you walk out of the restroom. And I'm like, okay, we're just going to call this a divine appointment. And I said, here's what I want you to do. I want you to turn around. I want you to go back, and rather than wait for him to introduce himself to you, you introduce yourself to him. You go to him and say, I'm here. She did, and she became one of the best youth sponsors we actually had for girls in that youth group. But here's the thing. God's not calling you because you look the part, because God doesn't care about that. God's not calling you because you're the best. God doesn't need you to be the best. He's already the best. What is his word to Moses? It doesn't matter who you are. Why? I am with you. And then we get to the second question in the text. Moses says to God, you're with me, so who are you? And the reason he's asking this is he says, if I go to the elders of Israel and I say to them that the God of our fathers is calling me to you, what are they going to say when they ask me your name? Now, they might be asking this for three reasons. One, Israel has lived for generations in a land that's filled with other gods. So they could honestly be saying, well, which God has come to you? Or it could be that Israel's being told that they're called to worship God. The whole command of Moses is tell Pharaoh, I want my people to go to the wilderness so they can worship me. Well, if you're going to worship God, you have to know what to call him. What are we supposed to call this God? Who are you? Or it could be this question. They might be simply saying, you've told us that you've seen our plight. You've told us that you're wanting to deliver us. Where have you been for the last 400 years? If I go to them and I say, God wants to act, they might ask me, and who is this God? What is this God in charge of? And what is God's answer? God's already identified himself as the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, the God of their fathers. But now he gives this answer, and it's simply this. You tell them, I am the God who is, who I will be. Or, and because I'll give you a Hebrew lesson here, the word he uses, he gives an answer. It's not a noun, it's a verb. And God doesn't give a verb that's a complete action. He gives a verb that's an ongoing, unfinished action. And God says, I am who I am, or I will be who I will be. And what God is saying by that answer is simply this: Moses, I am the God who acts, and you cannot control me. I'm in charge of myself. You're wanting to know what I'm in charge of? You're wanting to know where I've been? You're wanting to know what my name is so you can call on me? Moses, I'm the God who simply is. And because I'm the God who is, I'm the God who will act for my people. One of the most amazing things we learn about God in this story is that God isn't just a noun. God introduces himself with a verb. God is the one who's going to act for his people. If he was the God of a particular thing, then we could hold God to that one thing. If he's the God of the rivers, his influence ends when the rivers end. If he's the God of the desert, his influence ends where the desert ends. If he's the God of the camels, his influence ends when you bring in horses. But instead, he's the God who is who he is, who will be who he will be, which is another way of saying there are no boundaries on me. And I'm telling you, Moses, that I'm going to set Israel free. He's the God of the past. He was the God of their fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That God that you've heard about, the God that told Abraham to move to a new land, the God who maintained Isaac through trouble, the God who brought Jacob from trouble to back home again, that's the God that I am. I'm the God who sees my people. I see their misery. I hear their cries. I feel for their situation. I'm the God of the past. I'm the God who's here in the present. And Moses, I'm the God who's going to guarantee your future. Here's the thing that we learn about God. Because God has been there in the past, we know he can be there in the future. In fact, I sometimes like to say this about God. His actions in our past support his promises for our future despite the circumstances of our present. The actions of his past. If I did it for Abraham, I can do it for Israel again. Don't let the fact that you're slaves now make you think that I'm not in charge. What I did before, I'm going to do again. Then Moses brings a third question to God. Three questions. Who am I? Who are you? And then this third question is the killer. He simply says to God, and what if they don't believe? What if they don't believe? I'm going to go to Israel. What if they don't listen to me? And here's what God says to Moses, and I love this. I'm going to read look at the passage in a second. But he says to Moses this. Number one, the elders of Israel are going to listen to you. Number two, Pharaoh is not going to listen to you. I'm sending you to the elders, and they're going to support you. But then you're going to go to Pharaoh, and he's not going to support you at all, Moses. In fact, Pharaoh is going to be so resistant, it's going to take a mighty hand from me to actually change your situation. And what I love about this, and what I would like everyone to know, whoever hears God's call, is when God calls you, God never promises that everyone's going to agree. Here's the thing. The call of God, if one lesson is God doesn't need you to be the best because he's already the best. The second lesson is the call of God doesn't require everyone to agree because God already agrees. The call of God doesn't require everyone to agree because God already agrees. He tells Moses, you're going to walk into a situation that's going to be hard. You're going to walk into a situation where it's going to take my mighty hand. You're going to walk into a situation where you're going to have to face this again and again and again. But it doesn't matter because I've already guaranteed the outcome. Here's what's going to happen. And then Moses asks the question, well, what if they don't listen? What if they don't respond? And God simply says this to Moses. He says three questions, and I love this. We're going to start ending with this. But Moses asked God three questions. And the three questions are what? Who am I? Who are you? What if they don't believe me? God asked Moses three questions. And God's three questions are this. What's in your hand? Who created mouths? and what about your brother? Number one, what's in your hand? Moses, I'm going to give a sign that if they see this, they'll believe you. What's in your hand right now? Well, my hand is a staff. Throw the staff on the ground. He throws it on the ground. It becomes a snake. Moses immediately runs away because Moses is smart. God says, pick it up by the tail. How many of you know you don't pick up snakes by tails? Pick it up by the tail, and it becomes a staff again. He says, stick your hand in your cloak. He does. Pulls it out. It's leprous. Stick it back in. He does. Pulls it out. It's now healed again. And he says, if they don't believe these two signs, take some Nile water, throw it on the ground, then it'll turn into blood. If they don't believe the first two signs, they'll believe the third. Here's what's interesting about all of these signs. God is taking things that Egyptians already had a meaning attached to. For them, serpents represented healing. For them, the Nile represented life. And God's showing them that the things that they trust in are the things God actually has power over. These are the signs. But what you're trusting in, I'm actually the God over. I'm the God over healing. I'm the God over snakes. I'm the God over the Nile. I'm the God over water. I'm the God over blood. Moses, these are the signs I'm giving to you. Now, I had an uncle. In fact, he's still alive, so I still have the same uncle. He, before he retired, was the chief research engineer at the University of Kentucky. A very, very successful engineer. His specialty was studying the conditions of roads in earthquakes and what kind of road could survive an earthquake the best. My uncle also was an associate pastor at his church. My uncle at times was a very busy man. And he said that once in his life, he was in a period where it seemed like everything was coming at him at once and he was constantly busy. And he said that I had a dream one night. And in the dream, I was seated like I was at the center of the end of a very long line. And in the line were all my responsibilities that were waiting to talk to me. I had my job, I had my church, I had my wife. My wife was actually in line waiting to talk to me. And he said, towards the end of the line, I saw Jesus. And Jesus steps out of line and comes up to my chair to talk to me. And I said to him in the dream, Jesus, you just cut the line. I need you to get back in line. I'll get to you when I'm ready. And he said, and Jesus did it. He got back in line. Then as I'm still dealing with, he gets out of line again, comes right up to me, and again I send him back into the line. I don't have time for you, Jesus. Get back in line. And he said, when I woke up from that dream, I woke up already crying. And I got on my knees and I apologized to Jesus for ever making him stand in line to get my attention. Here's the thing about that. All of those things in line were things my uncle was putting his trust in. But none of it mattered if Jesus wasn't first. What God's doing in this story is he's going to show Israel and he's going to show Egypt that everything else they put their trust in isn't enough. It's only God. And so he says to Moses, what's in your hand? Then Moses says to him, finally, God, look, he asked three questions. Finally, he says to this, God, you're asking me to go and speak to Pharaoh, but I got to be honest with you, I cannot do it. I can't speak. I'm slow to speech. You know that I'm not any good at this. Please, God. And God's response to him is in the second question, well, who created mouths? Again, I don't need you to be the best. I'm just asking you to go. And then finally, Moses says a third time, God, he doesn't even ask a question. He simply says this, would you please send someone else? We've had this whole dialogue for two chapters now. I've asked who I am, and you told me, you're with me. I asked who you are, and you told me, the God who is. I've asked what if they didn't believe me, and you gave me signs. I told you I can't speak, and you said you created my mouth. God, you're not taking the hint. How many know sometimes if someone keeps giving you objections, you're just not taking the hint? God, just call someone else? And God's answer is simply this: what about your brother? He's coming. I'll have him speak for you. You speak for me to him. He'll speak for you to Pharaoh. It'll be like you're God and he's your prophet. God will not let Moses get out of this. And I love that, because no matter what our objections are to the call of God, God could say the same three things to us. Number one, what's in your hand? God, I'm not ready for this. God, I can't do this. Look, if I called you, you were already somewhere in life and something was in your hand. I can use that. Here's the thing. God never calls you to be just like somebody else. And the reason he doesn't do that is because he already has them. God might be calling you into leadership, but he's not asking you to be Mark Dean. And you know why? Because he already has Mark Dean. He doesn't need you to be Mark Dean. He's calling you because of what's in your hand. And you say, but God, I'm too limited. Well, he created the mouth. He created everything about you. He's the one in charge of this. And you say, God, please send someone else. He says, look, I'll send people around you. I'll send you support. But I'm still calling you. And here's the thing I want to highlight as we come to the end of this. If God ever reveals himself to you, it's because he's calling you. There's not one person in the story of the Bible who ever had a revelation of God that God wasn't intending to use them in some way. If God reveals himself to you, it's because he wants to use you. And if God calls you, let's go to the last slide here. If God calls you, then God is promising to support you. If he reveals himself, it's because he's calling you. If he's calling you, he's going to support you. And if he supports you, that's all the confidence you need. Three lessons I want to give you about calling, and we're going to close in prayer. Number one, the call of God does not require that you be the best, because God's already the best. Number two, the call of God does not require everyone to agree, because God already agrees. And number three, the call of God does not require our excuses, because God is reason enough. Because God is reason enough. If he calls you, he'll support you. If he supports you, that's our confidence. Now here's the thing. The calling that we all share is the calling to follow Jesus. You might say, well, I don't feel like God has ever called me into full-time or vocational ministry. That's not the major calling of the New Testament. The major calling of the New Testament is to be a disciple of Jesus. If God reveals Jesus to you, that is him calling you to Jesus. Anyone who's ever been introduced to Jesus was at the same time being called to Jesus. His revelation equals his calling. And if God is calling you to Jesus, God will support you as a disciple of Christ. And you can live this life because you have God's support. There's not a person in this room who hasn't been called by God. And I can prove it because I just told you about God, and that's enough reason for his calling. There's not a person in this room who isn't being called by God. But there may be some in here that God is calling you not just as a disciple, but he's calling you to a particular thing in your discipleship. Maybe it is some kind of vocational ministry. Maybe it's what he wants you to do at your workplace. But he's saying right now, there's something in your hand. There's something I want to use. There's something you have that only you can do for me. And I'm calling you to that. And what I want to ask as we close in prayer is I want you to be open to saying yes to God. Number one, I want you to be open to saying yes to Jesus. If you're someone who said, I've never given my life to Jesus, I've never asked Jesus to be my Lord, God is calling you to that right now. And he's not just calling you to a prayer, he's calling you to a kind of life that will change you from now through eternity. But as someone who's already a follower of Jesus, there is things that God wants to do with you. There's ways that God wants to use you. And there's no excuse you can give God that's going to be good enough for God to leave you alone. Can I say that again? There's no excuse you can give God that's going to be good enough for God to leave you alone. He has a place for you. He has a plan for you. And all we have to do is say yes, because God's calling is already His promise of support. And if He supports us, that's all the confidence we need. Let's pray.